This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Did fracking kill off peak oil? Or just the world's hope of alternative energy? Coming up, energy guru Richard Heinberg on his new book, Snake Oil: How Fracking's False Promise of Plenty Imperils Our Future. But if conventional society can't power down, maybe we need a power shift. Two budding youth activists heading for the October Power Shift meetup in Pittsburgh tell it like it is. Later we'll hear Howard University senior Brian Menifee. But Radio EcoShock starts right now with this moving story from West Virginia. I'm Alex Smith. Maybe it's easier to be an activist with a degree blending into a big city. It's never been easy for Adam Hall. He is an example of why we do need a power shift in many ways. Adam, thank you for speaking out, and thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. It's great to be here.
So where are you from, Adam?
I'm from a little town called Glendaniel, West Virginia. It's in the southern extraction community in the central Appalachian Mountains. I live kind of at a hub where most of the surface miners go to and fro from work. There's no active mining directly where I live, but it does have a way of helping keep the businesses, keep the momentum going for mining down in the lower portion of our state.
And talk to us about the nature you knew when you were young and then how you drifted into city life.
When I was young, my parents were still together, so it was really easy for me to just kind of be in the woods. And even after they separated, we still had, you know, an abundant forest right around anywhere I could go. But as I started getting older, my mom started needing to find more work in closer work locations. We were forced to move into a larger city urban area. So I was forced out of the woods into, you know, the concrete jungle, I guess, is the best way I can describe it. And it was roughly about 13 years before I was able to get back into the woods. And in that time, I forgot a lot about it. So I'm still catching up on a lot of my childhood, you know, I feel.
And then you did what many young people from Appalachia do. You joined the military. Is that right?
I did. When I was getting to the beginning of my junior year, I started realizing my academic career would be halted if I wasn't able to come up with the money. I didn't have a whole lot of access to like how to navigate through scholarships or any kind of work study programs or anything like that. So we did have recruiters who came in very frequently who mentioned that we could get the GI Bill for college education if we completed our service in the military. They don't seem to tell you all the hoops you have to jump through in order to get that money. I completed 4 out of a 6-year contract, and there was so much that after so many experiences across seas, I rebelled, resisted a lot while I was in. They did chapter me out eventually, and it was a tough decision to make, knowing that that would be a mark on my record. I'm not very proud to have that mark, but it was either get myself chaptered out or, you know, never being able to come to grips with what was, when I talk about the military, I get so many different emotions that come through. It's really hard.
It's not easy. And, you know, Adam, I think this is a powerful part of your story because I know at least a half dozen other vets who think their country could be better. Many served overseas. Now they're activists who are trying to fight peacefully and they still expect to win. Have you met other vets who are concerned about, for example, out of control climate change?
I've met one vet in particular, and she's been really, an inspiration to me. Her name's Maggie Martin. She works for Iraqi Vets Against the War. I always felt like she's a really powerful voice, and she's really highly motivated. I like to keep up with what her work and everything. Her work kind of motivates me to continue doing the grassroots work here in southern West Virginia.
It sounds like your family has been wrapped up in Peabody Coal, and how could it be otherwise where you lived? Does that make it hard to criticize King Coal?
First of all, I really just want to stress that Peabody Coal is a demon on earth. My stepfather worked for Peabody almost 30 years, and he never worked for Patriot Coal one day. But when Peabody sold their union obligations to Patriot in this building, a company that was designed to fail, you know, it didn't just take my dad down, you know, it was on the verge of taking down, you know, whole communities in this area who worked very loyally for Peabody. And to have them turn their back on that kind of loyalty, there's nothing more than just absolute heartlessness there. This was all coming to a head when Patriot announced that they were filing for bankruptcy and that the union retirees' pensions and health care would be on the chopping block with that. At that same time, we were given this opportunity to go to St. Louis to help organize with Missourians Organizing for Reform and Empowerment, or MORE, and Black Mesa Indigenous Support in Flagstaff, Arizona. We all came together for an action camp last January, and I was given a good opportunity to go up on the steps of Peabody Coal's corporate headquarters, their global headquarters, and I addressed all of my grievances, all of my father's. And before I went, I asked every UMWA vet that I knew who worked for Peabody, who were involved with this, and I asked them what they felt and if it would be okay to try to help give them a voice. I knew that they couldn't get there, but could I in some way, like, yell whatever I could at Peabody to make them listen? And I got so many positive responses from that. And so for what little time I had a bullhorn in my hand, I wasn't yelling to that crowd for my own sake. It was for my father's and his friends and those people that he worked with and, you know, ultimately who were crushed, blown up, or, you know, are suffering from black lung disease right now. That was why I was there.
And it wasn't just the people who worked in the mines who got that pollution. It was the people who lived all around them. Coal is terribly polluting. Well, have you witnessed mountaintop removal mining, and what do you see?
I've been around quite a few active sites and a lot of sites that are going through what they call reclamation. I've seen how they've set up the explosives and when they detonate the explosives. It's really, really, you can't understand what it looks like to see a mountain, you know, hundreds of feet in elevation and littered with vegetation and water and wildlife, just like in less than a decade, you know, be shattered, be reduced to rock, and that is it. And I've seen what the aftermath of those mining practices do. I've lived in a community where we had the worst flood that many of the elders in that community has ever seen. And these people have lived in that community for 60, 70, 80 years. And none of them could remember a time that they've seen whole bridges blown out, houses floating downstream from 12 inches of rain that came down. I've seen water come out of faucets that just, I mean, water is a clear, you know, it's clear. I've seen water come out milky white and brown and black, you know, things that they expect people to drink here and be okay with it. And then there's so many more things, like the air that people breathe, the things that you can't see are even scarier than the things that you can see. And that's what makes, I feel, this whole fight so much more difficult, is when we bring that issue up that their air here is actually absolutely toxic, you know, nobody will believe us. And it's hard to show them or get any kind of regulators in this area, any kind of morally obligated regulators in this area, to do the proper necessary testing to prove to legislators and lawmakers that indeed our people are dying just from breathing air.
It's like smoking a pack of cigarettes a day or something, you know, just to live there, and it shouldn't be right. Not for the kids, not for everybody. Who was Larry Gibson?
Larry Gibson was, in my opinion, the greatest man who's really ever walked out of a hollow in West Virginia. The stories that he would always tell me about growing up, he really lived a life that was harder than I could ever imagine, from being kicked out of his home when he was just a kid to getting work with GM Motors and being fired from GM Motors for suspected organizing, from being, you know, from coming back home and then like having company men come to his house and offer him money for his land that he loved, that he grew up on, that he had these like childhood memories. And where I feel like that was what he wanted to do when he went back to Capehorn Mountains. He was wanting to relive out some of his childhood that he was forced out of when he moved to Ohio. When Larry would not sell his land, when he would not budge off of his mountain, the companies who tried to do business with him, instead of leaving him in peace, they decided to blow up everything around him. Capehorn Mountain, Stanley Ayres Park, is a 50-acre land trust that is surrounded on all sides by mountaintop removal activity. You can go to the top of Stanley Ayres Park, or you can go into the Stanley's family cemetery, and you can look everywhere around and see absolutely nothing. Capehorn Mountain, where Stanley Ayres Park is, used to be one of the lower points of Capehorn Mountain. Now it stands as the highest. Larry's air up there is extremely toxic. There is no water. The blasts from around the from the operation sunk all the water up there. And this was all, I feel like, in an attempt to make Larry surrender. And it did the absolute opposite. It really pissed him off. It fired him up to the point where he became a force to be reckoned with, in my opinion. And he traveled, a lot of times, money out of pocket. Anywhere and everywhere where anybody would listen to him or lend him an ear, he would tell them the story of what was happening to his people in West Virginia, in Central Appalachia, in these extraction communities where they're blowing up mountains. He would go everywhere, wherever, to tell these people this. And it was 30 years. He worked for nearly 30 years on this issue. And it really... if it was not for him, we would not have an anti-mountaintop removal movement today.
And so that almost sounds to me like a kind of corporate terrorism with the government being part of it. You know, if you won't sell your land, we'll blow up everything around it. It doesn't get any worse than that. So how did Larry inspire you?
It was purely accidental, actually. I was just learning about the resistance to mountaintop removal in Appalachia. It was in 2009, and I met Larry I saw him around at events, but I never got to talk to him. But at this one point, I met him in a West Virginia caucus of residents who lived in West Virginia. I met him in this caucus at Georgetown University for this mobilization called Appalachia Rising. We talked about our experiences and what brought us to this mobilization, and I gave a very brief why I was here, what I was hoping to get out of it. I always tried to figure out what went through his mind, but I've never been able to. But all I know is that me and him ended up talking separately after that group meeting, up until about 6:30 the next morning, about just our lives, about why we love where we live. And he simply asked me, "I need help. Will you help me? Will you help us?" And I've never been a person to ever tell Larry no. Since then, I agreed I would love to help him. He had this idea for a program where he would recruit other speakers for his foundation to kind of cover more ground in the world, to give more people an opportunity to understand what mountaintop removal coal mining was. And I took off with him many times. I learned a lot from him just by sitting passenger side with him as he talked, and we drove 2 hours to 16 hours. And I would always, every time he opened his mouth, I would be more and more motivated to get this fight over with. I really wanted to win this fight. I wanted to end mountaintop removal before he passed away. But sadly, it did not happen. So even today, I have this utmost loyalty to his memory and his honor and what he did for me by inspiring me not only to stay here in West Virginia and fight, but to do everything I possibly can to bring as many people, as many voices to the fight that we possibly can.
Well, Adam Hall, many of us listening to you right now are burning electricity made from the coal that came from this mountaintop removal mining. So do you have a website or a Facebook page or any place you'd like to recommend we can tune in and find out what's going on?
One of the best ways you can find where your energy comes from, if you go to iHeartMountains.org, they have a link there where you can actually trace where your energy comes from. You can also check out Keepers of the Mountain Foundation online. We still have our speakers program. If you're anybody listening at once, would love to have one of our speakers out to give a more in-depth explanation on what mountaintop removal is and how the resistance is fighting in Central Appalachia, I encourage you to fill out a form to have one of our speakers come out and talk to you. I would also recommend the rampscampaign.org. The RAMPS campaign is a nonviolent direct action group based in southern West Virginia, geared by community voices. They have done many amazing anti-mountaintop removal actions, including a tree sit that halted work on one permit for 31 days. They're very amazing people, and I would highly encourage anybody listening, if they would like to take a direct stand on mountaintop removal, to come and join them.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, listening with you to Adam Hall from Coal Country in Appalachia. He's not a lawyer, a scientist, or a writer. He's an American who cares about our climate and our world. Thank you so much, Adam. Adam Hall talked about iHeartMountains.org. He meant ILoveMountains.org. Find out more about Larry Gibson at www.mountainkeeper.org. RAMPS, Radical Action for Mountain People's Survival, is where you get your action on. That's rampscampaign.org. All those links are in my Radio EcoShock blog at ecoshock.info.
But what does this mean? Let's look at the definition of modern agriculture. It's the use of land to convert petroleum into food. And we can see the end of the petroleum.
We've all been told hydraulic fracturing, fracking, will make the United States into the new Saudi Arabia. The UK, Poland, China, and probably everywhere else will get new energy riches too. Already, American oil and gas production have increased for the first time in decades. Has fracking proved the peak oil theorists wrong? Here to help us is one of the best-known writers on energy depletion. In 2003, Richard Heinberg published one of the first big books on the subject, The Party's Over, Oil, War, and the Fate of Industrial Societies. He's been publishing the popular newsletter since 1992. Now Richard Heinberg returns to Radio EcoShock with his answers to fracking. The new book is called Snake Oil, How Fracking's False Promise of Plenty Imperils Our Future. Richard, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Well, it's a pleasure to be speaking with you, Alex.
You say in your introduction to your new book that you need to speak to, quote, my people, the ones who have been warning about an energy shortage for years. Is the peak oil theory blown away by new technology in fracking?
Well, short answer, no, absolutely not. Basically, what we're seeing is peak oil in action. World production of regular conventional crude oil minus tar sands and tight oil has been declining since about 2005, 2006. Now, the shortfall has been more than made up for by tar sands and tight oil, and so world oil production has been increasing slightly in recent years, but at a cost, both financial cost. The oil industry is struggling. It's investing about twice as much in exploration and production as a decade ago, drilling twice as many wells to produce only marginally more product, and also an environmental cost because all of the new production is coming from expensive and environmentally risky sources like the ones I've mentioned, tar sands, tight oil, also deep water oil. So as time goes on, more and more of the oil that's produced a higher and higher percentage will be from these marginal sources, and that's going to be both a financial problem for the industry to be able to maintain production, and the signs are that they won't be able to much longer, and also an increasing environmental risk for the rest of the world. So basically, this is exactly what the peak oil theorists have been talking about for the last decade or more. And rather than talk about the death of peak oil, I think we should be talking about this is what peak oil looks like.
We should quickly define one term. What is tight oil?
Right. Tight oil is oil that's in reservoirs of rock that have very low porosity, or excuse me, permeability. So the oil or gas, the same principle applies to natural gas. The oil or gas is there, but it just doesn't want to move. So if you sink a conventional vertical oil or gas well into these kinds of rocks, you may get an initial little puff of production, but it won't last very long, and the amount of fuel produced won't be enough to pay for the cost of sinking the well. Geologists have known about these tight reservoirs for a long time, and we're talking here about the Bakken in North Dakota, which is a mostly oil-producing tight reservoir, and tight gas reservoirs like the Eagle Ford and Barnett in Texas, the Marcellus in Pennsylvania. These have been known about for a long time. Often they're called shale, like shale gas or shale oil. It's not always shale rock, but as a useful shorthand, that's just fine.
You talk about for a long time, and that sort of piqued my interest in something you wrote about in the book, that fracking has been around for a long time. It's not a brand new technology.
Yeah, that's correct. Hydrofracturing per se has been around for several decades, and it's widely used by the oil and gas industry, not just for producing from tight reservoirs, but also in conventional oil production, especially in secondary and tertiary recovery stages after wells start to decline. But what's different here is that when we talk about fracking today, we're mostly talking about the application of hydrofracturing in combination with sophisticated cocktails of chemicals. Up to 700 different chemicals are used, slickening agents, propants, and so on. And also together with horizontal drilling. Now, it's been necessary to combine these technologies in order to produce from these low permeability plays that we've been talking about, the tight oil and shale gas plays. And that's where the higher costs come from, and that's where the greater risks come from, because we're talking about wells that may cost up to $10 million a piece to drill, much more than a conventional oil or gas well. And wells that also entail much higher risks to air, water, and human health.
You do write about the environmental impacts of fracking, and we will get to that. But a lot of this book is about the economic illusion behind the fracking bandwagon. Beyond the energy companies, large and small, who are the players who are making big money from the fracking boom?
Well, you know, I would argue that the investment banks, Wall Street, has made as much money from the fracking boom as anybody else. All of the companies that are engaged in fracking, and mostly we're here talking about smaller companies, not the major oil companies like Shell and Chevron, BP, Exxon, but smaller companies like Chesapeake, Devon, Range, Anadarko, and so on. All of these companies are leveraged to the hilt. It costs them a lot to do business, and in many cases, they're not really making money from the sale of product. The way they're making money is through almost a kind of pyramid scheme where they're hyping the potential of shale production in the future as a way of increasing the value of their assets. And their assets, in many cases, consist of drilling leases. When this whole shale rush started just a few years ago, these small companies were competing with each other to lease as much land as possible. And very quickly, they leased millions of acres of land for drilling. Some folks in the audience may have seen the movie Promised Land by Matt Damon. It's kind of a fictional representation of what's been going on in the past few years in shale country. Well, it's by hyping future potential that the value of these leases is kept high, and companies are then able to borrow more on the basis of the value of their assets. They're also able to sell these shale drilling leases to other companies, including big companies like Shell and BP, and also foreign companies in China and other places. And that's how they've actually been subsisting. It's not so much on sale of product as on sales of assets, mergers, acquisitions, and so on. And Wall Street takes a big share in all of those kinds of financial transactions. So the companies are kind of, they're operating a kind of Ponzi scheme, if you will. And Wall Street is very happy to go along for the ride, and they make off like bandits one way or the other.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of the name of the report. I think it came out of the UK. I covered it not too long ago about the possibility that the whole world economic system could crash because the big oil companies themselves were like a Ponzi scheme. They keep talking about their reserves and their possible future money in order to raise new stock money now. Can you remember what that was?
Well, there have been several articles because there's an effort now to talk institutional investors into divesting from oil companies because of the climate risk in producing all of these fossil fuels. And the argument is if we produced anything like the reserves that the oil and gas and coal industry claim, then, you know, we'd have climate Armageddon. So one way or another, all of those reserves of coal, oil, and natural gas are not going to be produced, which means that the value of the assets of these companies is not as great as they're claiming. And once again, even the big oil companies use the value of their assets as a basis on which to raise more money through stock shares or borrowing otherwise.
Do you think fracking is going to be a long-lived phenomenon or short-lived?
Well, you know, as long as the oil industry lasts, I'm sure fracking will be going on. What's not so sure is that we'll see anything like the current rate of production. Now, it's true, over the past few years, the U.S. has produced a lot of natural gas and oil through fracking. U.S. natural gas production is at its highest point ever. And more than all of the increase in the last few years has come from fracking because conventional natural gas production in the U.S. is actually falling. Similarly, with U.S. oil production, U.S. oil production had been in a decline since about 1970. And just in the last few years, U.S. oil production has actually picked up as a result of hydrofracking in North Dakota and Texas primarily. Now, the claim of the industry is that this is just the beginning, that we have 100 years of natural gas and the U.S. is about to become the next Saudi Arabia. The data do not back up those claims. We looked at the numbers at Post Carbon Institute. We purchased the rights to data on over 60,000 currently producing horizontally drilled and hydrofractured wells, both oil and gas, in the U.S., and we looked at initial production rates, the rate of decline in production over time for each well, geographic location. What we found is that in each of the major plays where fracking is going on, there's a core area, usually just a few counties in extent, where production is pretty prolific and profitable. But if you get outside of those core areas, those sweet spots, initial production rates are much lower. Production rates decline very rapidly over time. So taking those decline rates into account, taking into account the high geographic variability and the quality of these plays, it appears to us that the claims that are being made for future production of tight oil and shale gas are wildly overblown. This is mostly hype. And before 2020, before the end of this decade, we'll be seeing declining U.S. oil and gas production, and perhaps rapid declines in both fuels.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
We will continue with Richard Heinberg on fracking snake oil in just a moment.